The Guardian.
Hello, this is Science Weekly. I'm Alok Jha. On the show this week...
In antiquity, in the time of the ancient Greeks and the Middle Ages, to be curious was something frowned upon.
Science writer Philip Ball piques our interest in the history of science with his new book, Curiosity. His take on how science became interested in everything. And...
And what Porges was able to do was to fuse these two theories about mammals and reptiles into a consistent kind of meta-theory about how our vagal nerve dictates our decision-making.
It turns out that procrastination may be a strength rather than a weakness, according to the writer Frank Partnoy. He tells us about the benefits of delayed gratification with his book, Wait. Speaking of delayed gratification, we'll be looking at this week's science news. And guess what? The word curiosity turns up again. Yes, it's the Mars probe that keeps on giving. This is Science Weekly from The Guardian. Week after week, we endeavour to bring you the most interesting, cutting-edge scientific ideas here on Science Weekly, from the ever-increasing complexity of molecular biology to the frontiers of physics and cosmology. And it's not presumptuous to say that the fuel in our engine is your and our curiosity about the natural world. So, every now and then, it's probably a good idea to pause that journey up Mount Curiosity, turn around and gaze at the vista that is scientific inquiry. And that's exactly what science writer Philip Ball has done with his new book called Curiosity. The book traces the structures, both social and technical, that led to modern scientific practice. When I met Phil to discuss the book, I started by asking him to give me a quick overview of why he called his book Curiosity.
The word itself has a more complicated history. In antiquity, in the time of the ancient Greeks and the Middle Ages, to be curious was something frowned upon. It was seen as a vice. It was seen as either looking into things that don't concern you, being a busybody, or even worse, trying to second-guess God, trying to being impious in terms of what we were trying to find out about. There were some things that God didn't mean us to know, and so we should leave it at that. It was only in the late 16th and particularly the 17th century that started to change. And that's really what I'm looking at. Why it was that, as I would put it, curiosity became emancipated. Why curiosity became seen as a virtue. And why people started talking about it much more. And in particular, what happened at that time was that it became acceptable to be curious about anything, not just the grand questions of where we came from and why the stars moved in the way they do. But the most seemingly insignificant things, like, you know, what you find in a drop of pond water or what a gnat's leg looks like. In previous times, to be curious about that would have seemed absurd. These were just trivial details of what God has made. But in the 17th century, they became the kinds of things that scientists looked into.
Well, they weren't called scientists back then, of course. The people who were curious, and I mean that in a sort of active verb way, rather than curious as in strange, which is something you do talk about in the book. And I think we'll use that in this way in the interview. The people who were curious were just people who were asking questions about the world around them. And from there, you have the arc that becomes science. But let's talk a bit about that time then. Who were these people? What were they doing? And how did they fit into this world where, as you say, curiosity wasn't seen as such a good thing to be?
Well, one of the striking things about a lot of the what we'd now call scientists from this period of the late 16th and the 17th century is that they often came from outside the academic system. They weren't at the universities. And curiosity itself arose outside of that system on the whole, that the universities, academics, had a set way of doing things which tended to involve looking at ancient texts, looking at what, in particular, Aristotle had written about a question. And, you know, that there was your answer. And if he hadn't written about it, it was because it wasn't important. What changed with these people was that they started not only to challenge the authority of those ancient texts, but also to ask questions that that Aristotle and others hadn't asked. And this began in the late 16th century with people who became known as professors of secrets. And they had this idea that nature was full of secrets that it was our duty and our mission to uncover, that we had to somehow burrow in there and find them out. And these were people who were working initially in a tradition called natural magic, which sounds completely unscientific, but actually it wasn't.
You mentioned the word magic quite a few times and the way it's changed its meaning. Are you trying to reclaim it somehow?
Well, I, in a sense, I am, although this is something that I think historians of science of this period have already done for a long time. It just, it isn't generally known that magic in those days didn't mean tricks, certainly didn't mean superstition. It was a belief that there were hidden forces, literally occult forces in nature that guided things, that made things happen the way they did. And there really are such forces, hidden forces, invisible forces. Magnetism was one. They knew that that existed. And Isaac Newton proposed another. Gravity, he said, was an occult force. It was this invisible force. And so the natural magic, as it was called then, was this idea that there were these forces throughout nature which made things happen in the way they did. And so it was a purely rational and mechanistic way of looking at the world. It was trying to replace superstition, which just, believed that somehow things happened miraculously, literally, with this idea, this web of forces. And that was something that was central to the development of early science. As I say, you can see it particularly in Newton's work. But a lot of the other people in the 17th century, Francis Bacon was one of them. And also Robert Boyle, who was one of the, was perhaps the foremost figure in British science in the 17th century, bigger than Newton, really. He also shared this belief that was inherited from this tradition of natural magic.
And so around the 17th century, these people were coming together. You mentioned Robert Boyle, Isaac Newton, and others. I mean, these are legendary figures in the history of British science. It was also around the same time the Royal Society was formed. Now, it didn't have the most successful first couple of decades. Tell us a bit about that. How does curiosity feed into the setting up of this now august body of academics who around the world are lauded for their cleverness?
Well, Francis Bacon, who I mentioned, was a key English philosopher in the early 17th century. He proposed that actually what you needed was a state-sponsored program of, as we would now see it, of science. He proposed this. In fact, he proposed that it should be done by a kind of brotherhood of almost scientist priests who held this special knowledge. And this was the model that the founders of the Royal Society in the middle of the 17th century explicitly acknowledged as their inspiration. So they regarded Francis Bacon as one of their sort of founding fathers. And this was really what the Royal Society was. It tried to collect as much information about natural history as it could. And they explicitly avoided leaping to conclusions, making theories. It was really initially about amassing information from all over the world about stuff that happens. And the hope was, and this was certainly Bacon's hope, that if you had enough information, you could somehow you could filter that down into theories and understand general principles. It wasn't clear how that was going to happen. Not even Bacon was very clear about exactly how that would happen. And in fact, science can't be done that way. That's one of the things that became clear. But that was initially the project of the Royal Society. And it was modelled, this idea of a scientific society was modelled on what had happened earlier, particularly in Italy, where there had been these kind of scientific societies that were at that stage trying to find out about these secrets that I mentioned. So there already was a sort of model for this. But the Royal Society really marks, I think, the time that it began to cohere as a sort of scientific mission. And you see other academies founded elsewhere in Europe, in Germany and France at the same kind of time. So this was the idea that they would gather knowledge about the world and hopefully, eventually, somehow turn that into understanding the principles of the universe.
Now, that certainly didn't happen. Overall, the Royal Society is not a place where you go to find new theories out. It's a collection of people finding theories out elsewhere and then being told that you're wonderful for finding that theory out. So, you don't criticise the Royal Society for doing that. It becomes an important part of realising Bacon's vision, even though it didn't do what he wanted it to do.
Yeah, I think it was an extremely important development, and the Royal Society in turn set the template for other societies elsewhere. But It's true, as you say, that to begin with, it had a very hard time. I mean, it was royal in the sense that its patron was Charles II, but Charles II didn't take it very seriously at all. He found it rather odd what these people were doing, and so did a lot of society as a whole. It did look peculiar, and it was understandable that it did, that here were this group of men looking into, you know, obscure things, looking through the microscope at bits of dust and looking at mould and asking questions that just seemed bizarre and irrelevant, you know, sometimes even perverse. So they had a tough time, and there were a lot of satires about the Royal Society that were written at this time. One of the most famous at the beginning of the 18th century was what Jonathan Swift wrote in Gulliver's Travels, where he satirised the Royal Society as a sort of group of bumbling professors who didn't do anything practical. You know, they were sort of cut off from the world. They were the archetype of the boffin that we now have, of the egghead, who is completely unworldly. So the Royal Society really suffered from this, as well as from accusations that what they were doing might still be a bit impious. It did suffer and it did struggle to survive in the early years. And eventually it emerged, as you say, as something a bit different, as, you know, not a research institution as Bacon had envisaged it, but almost a kind of clearinghouse of science that was being done, which is how it functions now, really.
Now, a lot of things that a lot of modern scientists would say that they're curious people, they're interested in the world and they're asking questions about what's happening, and it all stems from those the initial things of looking at a microscope under dust looking at dust under a microscope rather, and these sorts of esoteric things. Curiosity driven research is the sort of the prime thing that many scientists want to do these days, but they also ask us to marvel at the world and look how beautiful it is, and look through the lens of wonder. Now, this is a word you use in the book as well, wonder, as being a sort of troublesome brother of curiosity. And I wonder why, because surely having wonder about the world is the beginning of curiosity.
Well, in a sense, having a sense of wonder about the world is the beginning of asking questions about it. In fact, this is what Aristotle and Plato agreed on, Aristotle said a philosophy begins in wonder. But wonder was a tricky concept in the Middle Ages. It was what was preferred to curiosity. It was seen as the sort of suitable alternative to curiosity, because wonder was supposed to leave you in awe at what God had made, that you just fell on your knees, if you like, at this, you know, wonderful thing that God had made. And, you know, that's one of the temptations of wonder, that you leave it there. You're just sort of, you know, awestruck. So, you know, it's a complicated emotion. And scientists today, I think, aren't necessarily always very clear about the role that wonder must play. Some feel, as you say, and as Carl Sagan said, that our inquisitiveness, you know, begins with wondering, staring up at the sky in wonder. For other scientists, wonder is what comes once you've done the hard work and have understood what's going on, and then you think, wow, it's amazing that, you know, somehow nature has made that happen. So, you know, does it come before or after the science, if you like, and what's the appropriate role for it? I think we can see wonder being used for, if you like, selling the experiments at the Large Hadron Collider. And, you know, I think to some extent appropriately that we're being encouraged to wonder that we can look into these questions about the early, very, very early stages of the creation of the universe. And that's great. But I think that you have to recognize that wonder has this difficult history, and that, you know, for a lot of people, wonder does lead to a kind of astonishment, which literally means turning to stone. It just kind of petrifies you. It, you know, stops you from asking questions.
But in a sense, though, I mean, the meaning of the word wonder is slightly different in some respects, because if I say I'm wondering something, it often means I want to know something. So I guess that these words do change in their sort of evolution.
They do, and it's really telling how they. I mean, that's a great example. You know, that if when you stop to think that that's what it means, it's really telling you something about the role that wonder has. And curiosity is the same. You said, you know, let's use it in the sense of inquisitiveness rather than strange. But actually, of course, that is what it could mean in the early days. That a curious person could mean someone who's slightly odd. It could also mean certainly in the times of the early Royal Society, someone who was just very careful. Has the same Latin root as care. So something that was curious, could mean all sorts of things. In fact, there was no well-defined meaning for it at all. So it could just mean something that was done with care. It could mean, if you talked about an object that was curious, it could mean something that was expensive or rare or exotic. And that was often the focus of the attention of these early scientists, that they tended to focus on things that were weird and, you know, amazing, which didn't give you a representative selection of things to study in the world. And that was one of the struggles that the early scientists had, to get away from that tradition of looking at strange things and to actually sometimes focus on the mundane.
For me, the word that I think when you say criticizing wonder as a sort of place to stop thinking, for me that word is now awe. I suppose these meanings shift along. And something else, as we're talking about words, which I noticed in the early chapters of the book, was that you mentioned the word occult, and that was used by Aristotle to mean something hidden. Nowadays, of course, occult has a completely different meaning, a very sort of anti-scientific meaning. And in a sense, occult was just, we just don't know about that yet before, in the same way that magic, as you were saying earlier. So I think that the etymology of these words can tell you a lot about how society thinks differently now to then. Can we move on to how curiosity works in the scientific endeavor today? I mentioned the words curiosity-driven research, which was something that scientists always talk about. But is research still driven in the same way now, modern scientific research? I mean, the 17th century, there was no real structure for natural philosophy of this kind of the sort we have today. We have a very organized system. If you want to be a scientist, there's a particular path you go down to do that. Back then there wasn't, and people asked all these questions with no overarching theories. Is curiosity still a major part of that, or is it more business-like nowadays?
Well, I think one of the things I wanted to do with the book is just to challenge, this word is, as you say, used a lot by scientists now, curiosity-driven research, and I just wanted to perhaps encourage people to be a bit more reflective about what that means, because what often is meant by that is research that isn't trying to go towards a particular goal. You know, it's open-ended. They often talk about blue skies research, and I think it's very valuable to stress the value of that, and that it is becoming harder to do that, that research is becoming more goal-oriented. And that is a problem that, you know, it's important to challenge. But I also agree with you that it's harder to be curious in the sense that Hooke and Boyle and Newton were, partly because science is more structured. One thing that strikes you about those men is they had no particular scientific discipline. They were interested in everything. And, you know, it's very hard. It's virtually impossible in science now to be interested in, you know, whatever takes your fancy, partly because it's become so much sort of specialized, and partly because it's sort of institutionalized. And that's a problem. And I think also I just wanted to sort of suggest that it's a problem in the sense of how big science has become. The Large Hadron Collider, the experiments there to look for the Higgs boson, you know, that's often said to be curiosity driven, and that there's no application that's likely to come from that. We just want to know the answer. And that's great. But I, in some senses, I think it's hard to see whether that's genuinely curious in the sense that Boyle and Newton and Hooke could be, because it's so huge, it has so many people and so much money involved. You've had to agree in advance, years in advance, what you're going to be curious about, these particular questions that we're going to ask. There isn't room, and there can't be room in a project that size, for the kind of ad hoc curiosity that you see as a benchtop scientist doing cheap research, where you just find that something comes up and you think, what's going on there? And you just follow your nose and follow that for a bit. And very often it's that kind of intuitive curiosity, really, that leads to extraordinary things. And, you know, the bigger the scale science becomes, the harder it is to build in room for that kind of curiosity.
I think that's a good point to end. Phil, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Curiosity, How Science Became Interested in Everything, is published by Bodley Head and out now in all online and offline bookshops. From the curious to the even more curious, I'm now joined by the dazzling display of science fans to talk about this week's news. Ian Sample is The Guardian's science correspondent. Robin McKee is The Observer's science and technology editor. And we welcome back Dr. Geraint Jones of University College London. Welcome back to you all. Let's have an update on the Curiosity rover. Geraint, you're our resident space expert. What has Curiosity been doing in the 4 days or 5 days it's been on Mars at the time of recording?
Well, it hasn't moved yet, but it has been very busy. They've been checking out its systems since landing, and as far as they can tell, everything's working fine. So as I said, the wheels haven't started turning yet, but it's lifted its camera mast, which is really vital because it's carrying the navigation cameras that help it move around, and also the colour mast cam, which takes beautiful colour images of the surroundings.
So, we saw some of those earlier in the week.
That's right, yeah. So
barren red landscapes.
Yeah, beautiful. I mean, it's very subtle, the colour changes and things, but the fact that you can see haze and things in the atmosphere, so there's dust floating in the atmosphere. So on the moon, when you're looking at the horizon, everything is just crystal clear. There's nothing to block your view, but on Mars it's different. It's very Earth-like, with haze in the atmosphere, and you can tell that some things are further away.
And so at what stage do we start getting the exciting science results?
Well, I think we're already starting to get them trickling in, but next week things should change dramatically. They're sending the data back via spacecraft that are already orbiting the planet, so like Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter and Mars Odyssey. So they've been quite tentative up to now, sending back data gradually, but they're going to increase the data rate up to 2 megabits per second. So that's almost
broadband.
I know, it's at the very, very end of the definition of broadband speed.
There are people in rural Scotland who've got better broadband connections than that, aren't there, Robin?
I wouldn't know about rural Scotland. I'm a city boy.
Go on. The data rate goes up, which obviously means that we're going to get better quality data and images.
Yeah, so the cameras have already taken fantastic images, but they haven't been able to send them back yet, only thumbnails. But even the small versions of the images they've already sent back, they've been able to piece together into a really nice colour panorama of the landing site.
And so what's in store for the coming months? I mean, when does it start moving around? Do we know when it starts to sort of send back the ones I'm interested in, the laser-guided experiments, which is where it's going to vaporise rock and look through the spectroscope? That's what I want to see. I want to see pictures of that.
Yeah, well, hopefully it'll start moving next week. They've already talked about using the laser to look at a region very close to where the rover is now. So as it was coming down to land and being dropped down on cables to touch down on the surface, these rockets were firing from the descent stage, and they've actually scoured some patches of the ground around the rover. So these areas are grey, whereas the undisturbed landscape is more orangey, and they were openly contemplating firing this laser system at the landing at these scour marks to see if it's just contaminated earth, or maybe it's the landing has actually removed the top layer of oxidized, so this red material, and they're actually looking at the grey bedrock underneath.
Robin, you when we had our sort of Mars Fest on Monday last week, you didn't get your sort of 5p's worth. You're a fan of Mars. You're a fan of space missions. I mean, how did you react to the whole thing?
Well, I did actually get up early and
you watched it.
I'm a space nut, and I was absolutely delirious about this. I'm particularly delirious because if this one had failed, I don't know when we get another one, because America has really pulled the plug on the funding. There's a prospect of a medium-cost mission later on this decade, and we have a prospect of a possible European-Russian mission And that's your ExoMars, and that's your whack, really, to follow this up. At one time, America was talking about launching missions to Mars every 2 years, and that's not what we're going to get. Now, we've got an absolute beauty here, because this is a really all singing, all dancing thing that will do lots and lots. It won't find life, but it might find out if it was possible for life to have existed. And if you talk to astrobiologists, the one thing you really need to show that life exists somewhere in the solar system is to bring back a chunk of rock or a soil sample to Earth and analyse it for the actual signs of some kind of living form. And I don't see us getting that for 25 years for Mars.
Until then, I mean, this is the best we've got. This is the most sophisticated, most able scientific laboratory that's been sent to Mars, which we discussed last week. But you wrote a piece a few weeks ago about looking for life elsewhere. I mean, with the fact that we're not going to have a sample return mission for a couple of decades at least, given that other probes are going to other parts of the solar system, what's your sort of betting on where we find life first, if we do?
It's interesting. Probably the easiest bet turns out to be Enceladus, this moon of Saturn's that's spewing out water and organics straight into space. You don't have to land on anything. You don't have to drill for anything. You just sweep past it a few times and bring the samples back. The trouble is it takes 10 years to get there, and it takes you 10 years to get back and 10 years to design your probe. So again, you're back on the three-decade mission. If you want for something like one of the icy moons of Jupiter, again, it's the same. You've got to go there, land on it, drill a bit, think this looks good, and then send something else that might bring a sample back. Again, you're in the 20, 30-year timescale. So I don't think we're going to find unambiguous signs of life, extraterrestrial life, in the solar system by space missions for a good 30 years. So we have to look at other ways we might do it. And the obvious candidate for that is studying the atmospheres of exoplanets. These are planets that are going around distant stars elsewhere in our galaxy. And there are missions being planned to do that. The thing is, what you will see is, if you see an unambiguous sign of oxygen and water vapor in an atmosphere, then you know that almost certainly that has to be a life form of some kind that's doing it. But you won't really know much more than, oh, this looks good. It's got life on it. But you won't know what kind of life it is. You won't know what its genetic code is. Again, the only really going to get a chance of that if you bring back something from within our solar system. And then there's just the rogue elephant is we get a little message from a SETI mission saying, oh, by the way, this is... we're here. Nice to hear from you.
That doesn't tell you what kind of life they are either.
Again, no, absolutely.
Geraint, do you agree with Robin's assessment, or are you more hopeful for terrestrial missions?
Yeah, I think within our solar system, Mars is by far the easiest place to look. I mean, if you go to Jupiter or Saturn, another big problem as well as, for Europa, getting under the ice and things, another big problem is that you're in orbit around a very big planet and you need a lot of energy to get to escape again and get back to Earth. ECHO is one of the proposed missions. So that's the Exoplanet Characterization Observatory. So it's being considered at the moment by the European Space Agency. So that will look at the composition of planets as they pass in front of their parent stars. You can make out some of the atmospheric composition from looking at the way the light and infrared light is passing through the planets. So that's one hopeful way of maybe finding evidence of life around other stars.
The thing about Mars, the trouble is with that, is it may well have life. It's probably primitive life form. It's not going to be in the surface, which is absolutely battered by ultraviolet radiation. It's going to be underground. The question is it a few tens of centimetres underground? Is it metres underground? Or is it kilometres underground? And, you know, it could take a hell of a fight to find that. So far, we have just scratched the surface.
Yeah, I mean, there was one puzzle that came up a few years ago, and that methane is found at certain parts of Mars. So so the ExoMars mission, the proposed European Space Agency mission, which hopefully will go ahead jointly with the Russians now, that will include an orbiter that will specifically search for methane and find exactly where it's coming from. I mean, the chances are it's probably a natural process that's completely unrelated to life, but it is a real puzzle where that is coming from, and that should tie down exactly where on the planet it's from.
Let's move on to another story now. Ian, you're reporting on a story about how aspirin, well, there was a story a few months ago about how aspirin could reduce cancer risk, and this is a kind of update to that. So tell us a bit more.
That's right. So in March this year, Peter Rothwell at Oxford University had a study, well, there's several studies actually in The Lancet and one of the sister journals, talking about the effects on cancer of taking low-dose daily aspirin, so sort of 75 milligrams a day. And he then reported that they saw an overall lowering of 37% in deaths from cancer in people who took a daily pill for more than 5 years. Now, this was obviously a pretty big story, because aspirin is incredibly cheap. It's a well-known drug. It's been around for decades. People know its side effects pretty well. And the idea that it may actually have a substantial impact on cancer across the board, it seemed, was a huge story. Now, what's interesting is we've all heard of the decline effect, where, you know, subsequent studies show that an effect may be smaller than originally reported. And something which maybe that has come out, and this is in the Journal of the National Cancer Institute, a study of more than 100,000 Americans where they essentially, it was an observational study, so it's slightly different to the original one that was done, and that matters. But what was, these guys found that of people who took a daily dose of aspirin, a low dose of aspirin, they saw a more modest reduction in deaths from cancer. So they saw 16% lower overall risk, which is still substantial. And they're saying, okay, this is still interesting, but we need to be aware that it's not as high as was first reported. When you pick through that overall risk reduction of 16%, you get something like a 40% lowering of deaths from GI tract cancers like stomach, colorectal, things like that, and a smaller reduction in other cancers. Certainly, you've got no reduction in lung cancer from smoking, for example, in this. So some of it does sort of seem to make sense. But it's interesting. I mean, even, you know, on the back of these results, it's still really hard to give any sensible sort of advice to people. I mean, certainly the doctors are saying you can't now say across the board people should take aspirin to protect against cancer, because there are side effects like stomach bleeding, things like that. Aspirin can damage the stomach wall.
There are other things that aspirin has been indicated for, just taking half a pill a day.
Yeah, I mean, the reason these data on cancer actually came to light was because some people take a low dose of aspirin every day as to lower their risk of heart disease, because it thins the blood, and so if you're at risk of having blood clots and so on, then it's can be a beneficial thing there. Although you have to weigh that up again against the fact that you are presumably going to make things worse for you if you're prone to having bleeds, like, you know, from certain kinds of stroke. So this is always a real risk assessment you need to do here. So, and you know, these scientists, at least who did this study in Atlanta, are saying you need to talk to your GP if you're going to start doing this stuff, because you need to know your sort of personal risk from the side effects of doing this. But it's interesting that they don't actually know why aspirin is doing this, how aspirin may be doing it, but there's some nice ideas out there. I mean, one may be that aspirin is having an anti-cancer effect purely by dampening down inflammation. It might also, which I think is more interesting, one idea is out there, is that it may be reducing the accumulation of mutations that build up in cells, which turn them eventually into cancerous cells. And there's another effect that aspirin seems to have, which is that even if cancer develops, it metastasizes or spreads around the body at a slower rate. And so they think that aspirin actually prevents cancer cells from latching onto blood platelets, which circulate in the bloodstream. So if they can nail some of this stuff down, it's certainly a really interesting area scientifically, even if it's a little bit too early to know what to do about it medically.
Okay, Ian, thank you very much. Thanks to Ian Sample, Robin McKee and Geraint Jones there for breaking science news and in-depth analysis day and night. Go to guardian.co.uk/science. Frank Partnoy is a writer on economics and, in particular, on a growing body of literature called decision theory. He's a former banker whose desire to understand the nature of decision-making led him to write a book called Wait, The Useful Art of Procrastination. Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps spoke to Frank Partnoy. In this extract from the interview, Frank talks about the unconscious influences on decisions. In particular, he talks about the research of Dr. Stephen Porges of the University of Illinois at Chicago. He looked at the role of cranial nerves and heart rate control, which led him to develop something called polyvagal theory.
this is something I wasn't familiar with and actually isn't cited in the main decision research. Economists aren't aware of this research for the most part. But there's a guy called Stephen Porges, who whose work I found, and I spent a lot of time talking to him and corresponding with him about his theory called polyvagal theory. And essentially what Stephen Porges did a couple of decades or more ago was to try to change the study of psychology to focus more on physiology, to not trust words that were coming out of patients' mouths, but to try to measure what was happening inside their bodies. And he was particularly interested not only in the brain, although he's a neuroscientist, but in the vagal nerve, the 10th cranial nerve, which extends from the brain stem and winds around the key organs in our body. It goes around our heart and around our gut. And he theorized at first and then confirmed with experiments that there are two very different strands to the vagal nerve that evolved separately, a mammalian strand, as you say, and a reptilian strand. And they both do very different things. Essentially, the mammalian strand enables us to regulate our heart rate, to have a variable heart rate in response to stress, so that if we're in a situation that's highly stressful, we can ramp up our heart rate, but we can also move it down. And we can do this very quickly. Porges's measures of heart rate variability are in the milliseconds. This is not something we're aware of, but it happens. If you just take a moment now to breathe in and breathe out, your heart rate variability will have changed. It gets faster as you breathe in and slower as you breathe out. But it doesn't obviously affect your mental health in any way. But Porges's theory was that this heart rate variability measure was correlated with mental health, and he ran a number of experiments. We can talk about those in just a second. But the second part of the vagal nerve is maybe just as important, the reptilian strand, which evolved really as a shutdown reflexive mechanism that Porges describes it as not just fight or flight, but fight, flight, or freeze. Mm. That when we encounter great stress. And this is unfortunately particularly true when we're really young, when we're infants, that our vagal response will essentially shut down our emotional abilities. So that while the mammalian part of the vagal nerve is kind of like a high speed race car or a high speed high performance vehicle, where if you're on a winding road, the ability to accelerate quickly and decelerate or brake quickly is really useful and will give you a lot of comfort, even if you're being exposed to danger, that's the good part of the mammalian vagal nerve, but that the reptilian vagal nerve can be quite dangerous, can shut us down. And in fact, he discovered, the way he discovered it was quite fortuitous. He got a letter from a physician who had found that the mammalian part of Porges's theory held, that there were these responses that were in our heart, again, milliseconds long, that were correlated with emotional health, but that he was also finding that heart responses could cause babies, infants, to die because they were so extreme that they basically shut down their bodies. And what Porges was able to do was to fuse these two theories about mammals and reptiles into a consistent kind of meta theory about how our vagal nerve dictates our decision-making.
I mean, a good description I've heard him give himself is that to understand the difference between these two nerves, the mammalian and the reptilian, he says you walk into a pet shop and look at all the reptiles. It's not very interesting. They're just standing still. They're not mm-hmm. doing anything. Then look around at all the mammals, the mice, and they're running around there's no tomorrow. And so you can start to understand the two sort of differences in how those nerves act some way physiologically in the system. But to bring it back, you said that he did quite interesting experiments understanding the importance of this because he decided to see if he could figure out in young children, first at 9 months and then I think around 3 years, if he could see if there was a consistency, if there was consistency in how the heart rate was controlled, did it affect behavior or characteristics in the child? Can you talk about that a bit?
Yes. In one series of experiments, he brought some nine-month-olds in, and he tested them in various ways that were well-established in the literature. He used the Bayley Scales of Infant Development test. He surveyed the mothers and composed various measures, numerical measures, of the baby's behavior at 9 months.
While measuring their heart rate.
In addition to that, he outfitted the infants with a tachometer and measured their a cardio tachometer, measured their heart rates. And not just measured how fast their hearts were or how slow, but measured their variability. So basically constructed a respiratory sinus arrhythmia measure where a baby, for example, that had an average heart rate of 100, but if it were stressed in some way or were given a toy or some challenging stimulus, that its heart rate might vary between, say, 80 and 120. And that would be a high RSA or a high heart rate variability. But then another baby might only vary, it might still have an average of 100, but it might only vary between 90 and 110, and that baby would have a low heart rate variability. So he established those tests, and he had sort of the two different categories of tests, the traditional ones and then the new heart rate variability ones. And then he waited 3 years, as you say, and brought everyone back and retested the nine-month-old babies as three-year-olds. And what he found was quite startling, which was that the traditional tests, the Bayley test, the surveys of the mothers, did not do a good job of predicting behavior later. That well-behaved babies at 9 months were horribly behaved at 3 years. Incredibly patient babies at 9 months were impatient at 3 years. But that the one variable that predicted emotional stability, that predicted behavior at 3 years, was this heart rate variability measure. And it just blew people away and really opened up a field of research. And this utility of heart rate variability has been replicated over and over in studies of older children, of adults. And people have theorized that heart rate variability may be a reason why we have trouble delaying gratification. It may be a cause of asthma. It may be involved in autism and borderline personality disorder, that it may be something that's so important that one day we'll use it as a numerical measure of our mental health in the same way we use blood pressure or cholesterol as measures of our physical health.
Wait, The Useful Art of Procrastination is published by Profile Books. That interview with Frank Partnoy was just an excerpt of a longer interview that we'll be publishing in full in the coming weeks as a Science Weekly extra, so keep an ear out for that. That's all we have for this edition of Science Weekly. You can keep up to speed with breaking science news at any time on guardian.co.uk/science. But from me, Alok Jha, and Science Weekly producer Jason Phipps, it's goodbye.
For more great downloads, go to guardian.co.uk/audio.